What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardawar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we are updating you all on what's going on with the Microsoft Activision Blizzard acquisition. There's been a lot of movement this week, as that deal will likely close by next week, so we'll dive into all that with a special guest. We'll also be talking about the Apple OS betas, the public betas, all launched this week, so anybody can test them. And Sherlyn and I have a lot of thoughts on where all that stuff is headed. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And again, we are not doing live streams for the time being, but we'd love to start doing those again on Thursday morning. So if you have enjoyed the live streams, if you were one of those audience members, send us an email. Tell us how much you liked it, because I think that would help. Joining us to talk about the Microsoft Activision acquisition is Jordan Miner from PC Mag. Hey, Jordan, how's it going?
Hey, what's up? Thanks for having me on.
Nothing. You know, a lot is up. We've got a lot of news, but glad to have you on. Also, Jordan, you just wrote a book, right? Video Game of the Year?
Yes, I did. Yep.
You did. So we will be talking about that, but let's talk about this news up first. So I'm just going to sketch out what happened here. So recently, the FTC filed an injunction to stop this deal, the Microsoft Activision deal, before its attempted close date. I believe the FTC was worried the deal would be finalized before they had actual time to kind of review this merger. And they had initially sued to stop this whole thing before, too. But that process, that trial, would have taken months to happen. And the deal just could have kept going. So the courts have basically decided against the FTC, saying that they didn't prove that this deal would be harmful enough to the industry and that it's free to move forward. Microsoft was very happy about that. Then UK regulators, the CMA, said that they would be open to talking to Microsoft about this. If you'll remember, a couple months ago, they also announced that they would be basically pushing against the deal because they thought Microsoft, it would give them too much of an advantage in cloud gaming. Meanwhile, European regulators approved the deal just fine. So it's been all over the place. It seems clearer now than ever. Jordan, you've been following this. You cover games over at PC Mag. Can you sketch out, like, what did you think, like, as you saw this injunction attempt fail?
It's not surprising to me that it's ultimately going to happen. They put so much into this. They're so committed to making this happen. There's so much money on the line for everybody involved. I'm just happy to see that it at least went through this process, that it at least got really scrutinized. And it's very interesting as someone who follows gaming news to see all these executives and higher up people that we're very used to seeing in like a marketing context of just being like, we've got the best lineup, we've got the greatest games, having to get on be in a courtroom setting and just tell the actual very sober truth of we are losing. We don't
we are actually huge losers.
Yeah.
I'm a loser, baby. Why don't you kill me? Yeah. That's basically what Microsoft was doing quite a bit, too, because they basically painted themselves as sort of like, hey, we're losing the console market, right? Sony is the market leader here. Nintendo has a big piece of the pie. We are the smallest console manufacturer. We're so small. That is true to an extent, Jordan. But I also felt like some of that was also overplayed, right? This is Microsoft. This is one of the biggest companies in the world. But in this respect, yeah, sure, they're smaller than the competition. Did you think like that, the stuff we've been seeing from behind the scenes, was that actually the truth? Or was it like these companies just saying what they thought the courts wanted to hear?
Oh, yeah, it's still totally disingenuous, but it's disingenuous in just a weird opposite land way from normal video game kind of stuff. But yeah, they're Microsoft. They're massive. Again, they're going to spend like $70 billion just to be in a position to do that is you know.
It's just totally wild. And like, go ahead.
I was going to say also, I think there were some quotes saying or that came out about how like, oh, we can just outspend Sony. So, yeah, that's a real thing that a small company can say.
Yeah, totally. Like Microsoft basically has unlimited cash reserves. That is their superpower. Their superpower is not apparently spurring developers to actually release games, right? Because this is nothing new. They've been buying publishers. They've been buying a lot of small studios. What was it? Most recently it was Bethesda, which is finally starting to get games out there. Starfield is coming after a lot of delays. But what do you think this acquisition would solve for Microsoft, Jordan? Because, yeah, they have all these studios. They just can't get the games out. Would buying Activision actually help Microsoft right now, because I think the big problem with Xbox is they just don't have the exclusives, and the few they do have are kind of disappointing, to be honest.
Well, with Activision especially, so many of the deals they've had to cut to even get this to go through in the first place is having to be like, we're not going to have Call of Duty exclusive on Xbox. We're going to actually bring it to Switch and commit to having it on PlayStation for another like 10 years. And even if they weren't kind of being forced to do that, I think that would still be the smart play anyway, because like the value of Call of Duty, like any value it could bring from being an exclusive, you would be like what you would lose from not having it be on PlayStation, I think would dwarf that. So I don't think the exclusive stuff is going to come from Activision necessarily. There was a time where I thought that all these acquisitions for like smaller teams especially could really help bolster Game Pass. And I thought could maybe encourage more sustainable kinds of games. Like, oh, these don't have to be like huge AAA things. We saw earlier this year, Hi-Fi Rush, which I liked a lot, was kind of a smaller game that could be like a cool Game Pass shadow drop. But, you know, beyond that, I feel like we're not even getting like, I mean, Pentiment as well last year, but like, I feel like we're not even getting the smaller stuff I thought could be a silver lining to all these acquisitions. We're just getting more vaporware.
It's surprising. I mean, I think games take a while to develop, right? They take a while to get out there. I also think Microsoft just as a company is just bad at some of this stuff too. Before we go deeper though, Sherlyn, like, do you have any thoughts about this? Just in terms of like a big ass company like Microsoft trying to gobble up another company. This is one of the biggest tech acquisitions ever, to be honest. Like, if this does end up happening, do you have any feelings about this, about Microsoft potentially just getting bigger by eating a smaller fish?
I'm still thinking of when Microsoft tried to buy TikTok. So yeah, yes. Yeah. And wondering what that would look like now if Microsoft did buy TikTok, together with Walmart, it was. I don't know. I don't know what it means for the gaming industry, because I know there's a lot of like, there's a word for it when all these big companies buy smaller companies. My brain is fried enough that I don't remember. It's not oligopolization, but not monopolization either.
It's basically monopolization. Like it's slow. Yeah. It's a form of
I think
that.
It's mm-hmm. not great for consumers in general. Less competition is less good for consumers. As a not heavy gamer, I don't really like, it doesn't bother me as much, obviously. I don't see what kind of power maybe that Microsoft would really have if it had. But I mean, I also know that Activision is huge, right? But I also know Activision's been in the news lately for a lot of bad other types of controversial reasons, with all the sexism, with all of that stuff going on.
Bobby Kotick, yeah.
I don't really know if, you know, Microsoft buying it would help, at least on that front. I have plenty of questions around this purchase as like that have very little to do with the size of the company and have very little to do with competition and more about practices of the company at all. So
for sure. Jordan, I kind of agree when you said that it's a good thing this process just even happened. Like, even if the FTC didn't get its way ultimately, they did, and the other regulators, by pushing, definitely got Microsoft to be like, hey, we will make all these commitments. You know, 10 years, Call of Duty for Sony, and also Call of Duty for Nintendo, which is not a thing that even exists right now, right? Like, they were basically like, yeah, 10 years for Call of Duty for future Nintendo platforms. That's more than we have right now in the gaming world. So they're kind of saying like, yeah, this will benefit gamers by bringing this game to more players. So I guess like this whole process still helped, right? This pushback certainly helped. Sherlyn, I see you raising your hand. What's up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you brought up a point, Jordan, that like the EU or at least the European regulators had less of an issue with it. I'm very curious why, because they tend to be stricter than American people. Do they think that maybe Activision has less of an impact in those regions and that therefore the competition would be less of an issue?
I feel like across this whole thing, a lot of these agencies have really displayed their like just ignorance of gaming. Like,
showing their butts, yes.
Yeah, because in America, there was this whole argument about whether or not like where Nintendo fits into the marketplace, does it even count, which is a weird thing to argue, I think. And then, in Europe, I think they're really more hung up on like the cloud gaming thing and really thinking that that's going to be like the really dominant future. Which is possible, but I think if you're really into gaming, you could be very skeptical of that, as I am. So I think a lot of them just don't really know.
Do you think, basically by the FTC losing this fight, Jordan, that the UK regulators were just like, hey, let's just go with this, because they can't. There's no future where, you know, this acquisition is banned in the UK but is happening in the rest of the world, right? Like, what would that mean? That would mean Microsoft can't sell games there. Like, it would be very complicated, and that's also something I don't think they'd want to deal with, right?
Yeah, I think that it's just all going to happen. They'll give them free copies of Fable to mend the UK divide, and we'll
all the Fable, unlimited Fable for the UK. Everything is solved. I think that's all they need. You were also talking about Trillin, like what would this mean for Activision, right? As a company, they are kind of in the rough spot. Like, CEO Bobby Kotick has been criticized quite a bit for his behavior and his sexism and for the culture he's kind of supported there. He would I don't know if we have the actual info, but he would probably be out pretty quickly if this acquisition goes through. Jordan, from your perspective, do you think this is a good thing for Activision? Because I do feel like they've just been the Call of Duty company lately. Like, they everything has been Call of Duty for them, and they really haven't had room to do anything else.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a silver lining. Yeah, I mean, he would get a gigantic golden parachute, but him leaving would be good. This could be more lip service, but I think Microsoft has at least said that they won't interfere with, like, unionization efforts that I know, you know, that have been happening at Activision and Bethesda at ZeniMax, I think is Bethesda's parent company. So, you know, that's, again, the corporation can say what they want, but then at the actual bargaining table, things change. But just kind of putting that message out there, I think, is good.
Gotcha. I want to read some quotes here from Judge Jacqueline Scott Corley. And I think it's worth considering and thinking about, like, in terms of why the FTC injunction failed. And what an injunction means, by the way, is that just the deal couldn't legally go through. And they were trying to stop this before next week, because I believe July 18th was a cutoff date they had initially stated. And if the deal isn't done by that point, Microsoft owes Activision like $1 billion, and they also have to go back and rework the whole thing. So that would have been a huge mess. But Judge Jacqueline Scott Corley says this court's responsibility in this case is narrow. It is to decide if, notwithstanding these current circumstances, the merger should be halted, perhaps even terminated, pending resolution of an FTC administrative action. For the reasons explained, the court finds the FTC has not shown a likelihood it will prevail on its claim that this particular vertical merger in this specific industry may substantially lessen competition. So that basically, they think the court has not proven the case just yet. There is like a larger court battle that's going to be happening, Jordan, right? Like, the FTC is not done yet. They also announced that they will appeal this decision, but that likely won't happen before July 18th. So what likely will happen, it seems, is that this merger will go through, and the FTC will just keep fighting and pushing Microsoft. But it is much harder to deal with the situation once the acquisition is completed, right? I think they were just working really hard to stop that. Am I right there?
I think you're right, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, just good that they're not giving up, even if they kind of can see the outcome. Again, like, just make it hard for them. Make it hard for these companies to do this, I think, is their responsibility.
I think that's fair. I mean, we've been talking about this, guys, and I have said, like, I'm not really for this decision because Microsoft is just too damn big. I think ultimately it is not a good thing for any industry for these companies to get bigger and bigger and just so powerful. They'll say good things now. We have no idea what this means, you know, actually 5 or 10 years from now. So there's that. But it's going to happen. Clearly there was a lot of, like, pushback, and Microsoft had to, like, respond somehow. It'll be interesting to see where this all goes. Like, what is next, Jordan? You think it's just going to go through next week and we're going to start to talk about this combined company, I guess?
I guess. I mean, I agree with you. I also don't like this. I don't like the consolidation. And also, it's not even the most important thing, but also to see it get spun in weird, petty gamer console war terms has been just completely brain-breaking for me. But yeah, I mean, who else could they buy also? So, I mean,
hopefully. What were the rumors? The rumors were Sega for a long time. For decades, the rumors was Sega, because Microsoft basically helped Sega build the Dreamcast, right? The Dreamcast was running an early version of Windows CE. One of the executives, I forget the name.
Peter Moore was the continuity, yeah.
Peter Moore is the continuity. He went over to Xbox and then the Xbox 360. And there's all the, like, conspiracy theories, like, look at the Xbox 360. It is a Dreamcast 2.0. Come on. From the logo, from Peter Moore to everything. I feel like Sega would be a fun one. My question is, I don't know. Do you think Microsoft is in a place right now to actually get games out? Do you think there's, like, a problem at the top in terms of getting these games out, or strategically how they're dealing with the releases?
Yes. They have problems unique to themselves, for sure. They're also, like everyone, I think, impacted by pandemic stuff still. That, I think, is gummed up pipelines for all industries. But yeah, there's definitely, yeah, their first party output especially has been like anemic for
the Halo stuff. Yeah. Has just been like breaking my heart, because it was like, okay guys, the big launch title for the Xbox Series X and everything, sorry delayed a year after the launch of these consoles. Also, it launches kind of shit, like kind of, it needs a lot of work, the multiplayer has a lot of issues, nobody can level up. It just feels like they keep like stubbing their toes, right, when they try to do something. Okay, we're all excited for Redfall, everybody loves Redfall, everybody loves Arcane. Disaster. Phil Spencer is out there apologizing for the release of Redfall. I don't know. We're going to keep an eye on this. We're definitely going to follow all this news. Let's talk about your book, Jordan. Video Game of the Year. Can you tell us, like, what is this book? What was your inspiration for doing it?
Sure. So while the future of video games, who knows where that's going to be, this is a look back at the past 45 years of video game history. The whole structure of the book is that each chapter represents 1 year, and is my critical essay I've written on what I think is the most significant game of that year, from 1977 until today. So, you know, in 1980, I picked Pac-Man. In 2011, it's Minecraft. And, you know, just me arguing why I think that's the most significant game of that year, because it's, like, the best game or the most influential, or it was indicative of some larger trend or something. And with these sort of individual examinations of games, I'm trying to convey a larger, more comprehensive view of gaming history as a whole.
I'm loving the book. I'm making my way through it. I also, for full disclosure, I also did contributed a small blurb here around Chrono Trigger, because you don't have to ask me to write about Chrono Trigger and to reminisce about it. So I'm of the opinion, Jordan, that it feels like, especially like younger generations aren't always aware of what came before, especially when you're inundated so much with what's happening now and what the streamers are playing now. So it's really cool to have a bit of history. I feel like, wasn't Atari 50 kind of, it was a similar thing too, right? That was both kind of a documentary and also a way to play those games and a way to, like, you know, reconsider the context of those games too, right?
Yeah, that was an excellent compilation. Yeah, the work they did, all the interviews and stuff, and just having those games for sure. But yeah, but for the younger generation, it's not their fault in that there's just it's tough to legally play. Like, I mean, a lot of the picks in the book are very famous, very well-known games, but even to play all of them now would be, like, again, legally would be really difficult, if not impossible. And then, you know, you mentioned that you contributed a blurb. There's more than like 75 guest essays from people from across the industry, from PC Mag and IGN and Giant Bomb. And they, and, you know, I like that they contribute a lot more kind of deep cut picks. To play those would be even more difficult. So, you know, hopefully people can read about them and at least appreciate them that way. But to actually play them, to experience, you know, this interactive medium is a lot harder.
That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
There's, I should bring up this stat. So the Video Game History Foundation just produced a study that found that 87% of games released in the U.S. before 2010 are no longer commercially available. So that stinks. That kind of makes sense given the amount of games that came out on earlier platforms. But it's not only that they're not commercially available. There's just no way, even if you found those games, right? What do you have to dig up an old system, right? You have to make sure that hardware works. It feels like games are in a really weird spot compared to movies or books or music or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, because they're so dependent on specific technologies. And again, you know, that is a legitimate kind of issue that is like not really anyone's fault. But again, I also still put a lot of blame on corporations that don't view it as an art worth preserving. They don't have, like, there's no like significant kind of library system. They will keep games in vaults and sell them back to you years later. They will like just lose the source code because they didn't care. So, you know, I'm not letting them off the hook either.
They will implement emulators that they spend decades fighting against too. I'm looking at you, Nintendo.
Yep.
Okay. Well, you know what? In Microsoft's favor, I think the one good thing, one of the many good things they've done around games is like they've really pushed backwards compatibility. That is the thing that still exists in the current Xboxes. You can play some OG Xbox games. That's a cool thing. What would you like to see, Jordan, in terms of like game history and keeping these games alive? Like, would it be just like, I see people saying like maybe you should just like make copies available to researchers and to institutions like the Video Game History Museum. I don't think that actually helps consumers. I don't know what the solution is here, other than I really wish these companies figure out a way to get these games into people's hands, right?
Yeah, I mean, the giving it to museums is great. And again, it's tough because there's not like, unlike movies, there's no kind of like standardized thing that they could make that could play all games ever. And you wouldn't necessarily want that because that could stifle innovation with like control inputs and stuff. But I just wish there was like a public domain for games almost or something like that. Even if it takes 75 years for it to get in there, at least it's getting in there.
I would love to see that too. I want to shout out, like, there was, I think when the Internet Archive got Flash support, that was a big deal, and that was a way to, like, save early web culture. I think there was an update recently too, like, their Flash players got even better, and they're starting to compile some of the OGs, like, some of
there,
the old
there
stuff.
Is, yeah. There is something that I recommended, I don't know, yeah. a year ago, that is, like, an archive of all the Flash games that were on the Internet for something, and that's why I go and play over and over again. There's that Flash video called The End of Z World, remember?
End of Z World, yeah.
That's one of the catalogs, the catalog of Flash videos in that thing. I can't remember the name offhand.
I Am Late Tired is forever a mood. I feel like
I Am Late Tired.
I Am Late Tired.
It's really awesome to bring up Flash because in one of the chapters, the Super Meat Boy chapter, is about not just Meat Boy and kind of Xbox Live indie games, but also like how like Meat Boy especially kind of came out of the whole Flash gaming scene and Newgrounds. And Tom Fault.
Yeah, Newgrounds. Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tom Fault, the founder of Newgrounds, contributed an essay to the book as well.
Oh, wow. Nice. That's super cool. Nice. All right, so where can people find your book, Jordan?
Yes, the book is Video Game of the Year. It is where books are sold. It's out now. I know there's a podcast, but the book also has some really incredible artwork throughout from Ren McDonald.
Yeah.
So check that out. But yeah, it's out now. Amazon, whatever.
Buy it wherever. I would also say I love seeing books at indie bookstores. So if you have one in your neighborhood and you walk by and you want them to be there in the future, maybe occasionally buy a book there. This would be a good book to pick up there. Jordan, where can we find your work on the internet these days?
Well, on the internet, you can find it on PCMag.com. That's where I work. But now you can also find it in a physical object that I'm very happy about as well.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us. All right, let's talk about those Apple betas. Sherlyn, you and I, and also Nate.
And Matt,
yeah. We've all been testing all of these new releases. iOS, iPadOS, macOS, watchOS 2, right? Mm-hmm. There was a preview of that. All these things are happening. You are, as I'll say every time, you're the mobile goddess at Engadget. So what is... what is going on with the iOS and iPadOS betas? Because I could talk about macOS.
Yeah. I will be writing out the preview. I mean, I am writing out the preview for watchOS 10, actually. And Matt and I have been testing the iOS 17 beta. Matt will be writing and doing a video on that. It should be up by the time this podcast goes live. Check out the Engadget YouTube channel for really his breakdown. Big thing that me and Matt, I think the first thing we played around with was our contact posters.
Right.
Because there's some things that we can test and some things we can't test. The thing I really wanted to test that we can't test because we're both not next to each other in person is name drop and the new AirDrop features. Those you would have to have, you know, we were testing them on the developer betas. So we needed to be with people who had developer betas. Everyone was on iOS 17 for those features to work. So no, we couldn't test that. But part of that is creating a contact poster for yourself and making yourself look pretty when people call you. As always with beta testing processes, you kind of like some things are super buggy. Your phone's just going to kind of stop working. So if you've been thinking about getting a beta now that it's dropped, back up your data at the very least if you're considering it. But yeah, so there's a lot of like, oh, the first iteration of the beta didn't, you know, give me the contact poster showing up on phone calls, that sort of thing. But when we finally got around to it, I mean, me and Matt look like superstars now on each other's phones,
yeah,
right?
Because
it looks great. It's beautiful. I love the process of creating them like a lock screen, but it looks nice. I will say there's some things I wish it did better. You know, I want the name to display maybe like I want more control over where words appear on my poster.
Yeah.
I want it to cover my face, that sort of thing.
I'm testing it too, Sherlyn, and the contacts poster, from what we've seen, looks really cool. I want to say, I think it makes calls from people who don't have the contact posters a little uglier. Like, I don't like that, because it's like a blank screen, and maybe that'll change in the final release, but if you don't have the contact poster, it looks worse than before, I think, which is weird.
It looks sad. It's like kind of like, oh, poor. Another way Apple bullies people into updating their software. It's like, oh, if you don't use this new thing, when you call people, you're just going to look like you are on older software. It's just going to show.
If you're on Android, you're going to look weird. Like,
my God. Yeah, thing. I totally forgot about Android people calling iPhones. It's like they're not friends to me. So that's one thing, right? Another thing in iOS 17 and also in macOS, and Devendra, you and I had kind of talked about this a little bit, and some changes to FaceTime. It was really interesting at WWDC the way Apple demoed this. So on FaceTime calls now, you have new reactions that you can use. You can do so by long pressing on your face at the bottom right of the screen and then choosing an emoji. So if you choose the balloon emoji, some like cute little celebration thing will show up and animate around you and your face. And the way that FaceTime is able to identify and map out your face and have the animations happen around it is really cool. This does fireworks, this does rain for when you do like a sad face or down, like thumbs down emoji. It's pretty funny. But the more impressive part of this to me was during WWDC, like Apple demoed how if you make the Korean, this finger heart emoji or the like two hand heart sign, the shape, right? Yeah, Ben's making it now. If we were on FaceTime right now, we would trigger all kinds of funny like animations too.
I think this is going to get ridiculous because it looks very silly. It looks good. If you do the double thumbs up, it does the sort of like fireworks behind you, like a DiCaprio and Great Gatsby, that meme. But I can I can imagine business calls. I can imagine serious phone calls. Like, I'm sorry, this relationship is not working
out. Who's using FaceTime for... Yeah, it definitely happens.
But it would totally like mess up the tone of whatever conversation you're having.
I know. Yeah. I mean, so I guess what we're all going to learn moving forward is when you're on a FaceTime call on iOS 17 and you're talking about maybe like someone got a bad, you know, medical diagnosis or something, you want to avoid using some gestures in your call.
You can turn it off.
And here's the thing. Apple... You know, I think this is the deliberate design of it, which is that you have to hold up the symbol for at least 1 or 2 seconds before it will trigger the animation. So it's fairly deliberate. Me and Matt were like, it took us a while to figure out how to work it because it was like not automatically, like not instantly happening. And I kept going, hold it there for a while and then it will show up. So you need to hold your gesture
like 2 seconds
for at least a couple of seconds. Yeah. But that's fine. It's more like you want to be... It's good to be deliberate about this because you don't want anything in your scene to trigger this reaction or this animation. So I think that's almost smart on Apple's part.
It does seem like as a culture, we are getting to the point where our video chats are getting overly expressive with emojis and other stuff too. Like there was the viral thing going around. I don't know if you saw this, Sherlyn, but it was like a TikToker who just exists to like repeat what people are telling her. So it's a girl in like, you know, young girl like doing, they're just saying yes, 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 yes in the chat. Lick, lick. She does like slurping noise, like very weird things. I'm like, oh, this is just the downfall of civilization we're seeing here. Because it's like a girl basically acting like a puppy and repeating what the chat is saying. And that is her clout. Like that's how she gets clout on me online.
Okay.
It's weird. The internet is weird.
I will say, so there, that's FaceTime. And then there's like other things, messages. I mean, messages benefits also from the poster update. But here's one thing I noticed almost off the bat. That keyboard, the predictive typing, all of that stuff, that improvement is real. I mean, bugs aside when testing beta software, right? But like, I freaking hate typing on iOS. I really hate it.
It's gotten worse over the last 5 years. Like it has. Yeah.
But this iOS 17 update definitely makes predictive, at least for me on swipe typing, because I love to use swipe typing. On swipe typing is better. I haven't gone to a point where it seems like it, you know, when I want to say ucking instead of ducking. I haven't gone to that point yet where it like is able to allow for swear words in predictive or suggested words, but it's able to get like, again, it just feels better, more intuitive overall with the typing. Another feature that's coming to messages is if, oh my gosh, so many features coming to messages. Like the whole rearrangement of where your apps are, right? So you get more keyboard space, and I think that helps with just general layout and typing. But then you get transcriptions on voice notes built in, and that took a really long time to show up. I think we really had to wait till Dev Beta 3, which was the version just before the public beta, and it only really came through for me and Matt yesterday, which was the day it all like... the public betas dropped. So then you're able to start seeing transcriptions in voice notes that you send each other, which is nice, right? Because sometimes your friends just want to talk, but then you don't always have the time to listen. But now you can read it. And actually, it was very accurate, I think, the transcription so far.
I hate voice notes.
But now you're
going to
like it.
Because it's, now you could just read it. Also, what I really like, I'm looking at it here. in your recents field in the phone app, you also get like the voicemails like right there in that whole thing without tapping over to voicemail. So it's a lot more of it just feels streamlined in a way that's really good. Yep. So that's nice. Yep. Yeah.
And the fact you bring up voicemail, another new feature in iOS 17 is call screening. I don't know that I tested this with Matt. I can't remember. We've been testing this for a very long time. Because right after WWDC, Apple was like, hey, do you all want to try the developer betas? And here's what you to expect. So we've been trying it since dub, right? I still think that Apple's treatment of call screening isn't very smart, but you have an option of reading people's messages as you're leaving them for you, and then you can decide to pick up or not, which is basically how voicemail machines used to work in the day, except for you listen to them. But I can see the accessibility benefit here, so that's good. A new feature in Messages is check-in under apps. If you go into apps, you can choose to check-in. I thought that was really cool. I wasn't really gone over in depth at WWDC, but something that I learned about during my briefing. If you are going to, say, a date or you're going hiking and your friends are like, hey, we want to know if you're safe, right? You can send them a check-in that will automatically update your friends or your loved ones when you reach a certain geographic location, like home, for example.
Rather than saying, like, I will text you when you arrive, which is something I still do to friends, like when we hang out. Like,
that's totally fine. Yeah. And I like to do that to friends. I love hearing that from my friends. The thing is, sometimes you forget. Like, my friends are always like, text me when you get home. And I'm like, yum.
Yeah.
And I get home, the first thing I do is clean and shower. And then I forget.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, I'm not trying to be on my phone the second I step in my door. You know, so it's true. This makes it nice. I am concerned about some of the potential ways this might fail. If you were, for example, intercepted somehow and someone else has your phone and somehow they know your home address, they can pretend like you weren't, you know, like that you were safe when you're not. But I feel like that's me extrapolating a little too far.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of other stuff with iOS 17, I think it's all very intriguing, but overall, I would wait for the full review because it's still beta.
But if you want to see those cards, you do get the nice
those posters.
Those posters.
Those posters are so nice. Oh,
they're so high. You have months ahead of your friends to like, you know, set up your perfect poster.
That's true. If you want to, And you know what? Talking about buggy software, right? Mm-hmm. Like when I was first testing posters, I kept trying to save the image that I had made, the poster that I made, and I couldn't. I kept hitting save, and it just froze. The screen froze. Then I like quit the app, closed the app. I came back to it. It turned out I made 25 posters of the same pictures, so that was great. Buggy beta software for sure will create some issues.
Okay,
but yeah, if you want to start thinking about what to make, you can check it out. Just again, back up your data, or maybe like use a separate phone if you have one.
Backing up is always good to back up, back to the cloud, back up to your computer if you have a Mac nearby. You can still back up to PCs, right? So that's a thing. iPadOS I feel like has pretty much all these things, very similar.
Yep.
I'm looking at Nate Ingram's preview here. It seems it has a lot of multitasking updates. Not like a key big update feature, which is honestly how I feel about macOS as well. But a big word for iPad and a big word for Macs is widgets. What are your mm-hmm, thoughts mm-hmm. on the whole widget experience now across iPadOS? I'm not sure if you've seen it on Mac yet, Sherlyn, but widgets are a bigger deal now.
I haven't seen it on iPadOS just yet because I've been focusing so much on iOS and watchOS. Here's the thing, watchOS also gets widgets now. So it's been actually really interesting to see. I think that the widgets experience is much better and more helpful than before. I don't know if that tracks with your experience, Dev. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's okay. Their widgets, I just feel it's one of those things where I'm like, yeah, guys, this is not 2007 and Windows frickin' Vista. I'm not going to get excited for widgets, you know, like it's OK. I get the idea, like little bite sized pieces of software that show you glanceable information. I think for that reason, having widgets on like the iPad lock screen is nice.
Yeah.
Having widgets on the macOS lock screen or not the lock screen, but the desktop. It's kind of nice too, but it's like,
yeah,
I'm not going to get excited for this. Good job. Why didn't you do this 10 years ago? Nothing was stopping you. Yeah.
I guess. I mean, yeah, widgets were always this Android thing, right? And then like when Apple finally adopted them for iOS, it was like, oh, hallelujah. Yeah. And then they made them look more aesthetic than Android ever did. I do love some Apple widgets more than Android, even though I think Android widgets in general used to be more functional. I don't know about now. But yeah, I mean, they just give you more info at a glance. I honestly think that that's the best thing about widgets. And
that's cool. The thing. I want to hear from people who are using their iPads in ways to do actual work. So we're the multitasking features in Stage Manager. Let us know, you know, podcastinggadget.com. Let us know if you're using your iPad more for in that vein. I actually just recently picked up one of the newish, or at least last year's bigger 10.9-inch iPad. It was between that and an Air, but I wanted one that if my kids destroyed, I wouldn't feel as bad about. But I have that. I got the little Logitech keyboard for that. It is a together. It is a nice little 2-pound machine for me to take anywhere and like do some typing if I need to, and occasionally do some multitasking. Like, it's still pretty fast for what it is. Are you using iPads at all for any computing stuff, Sherlyn?
Not for any real computing. I have an iPad just to test certain features across like Fitness Plus or Health or that sort of thing. Speaking of which, I do want to shout out that iOS 17 does have a bunch of new mental health related features like journaling. I mean, the journal app. I don't think we got to really test that yet.
Yeah, not yet.
Beta just yet. But I am intrigued by some of them. Yeah, I'm not a big like iPad user. If it's not really because I don't like it or anything. It's just I have so many other machines. You know what I mean? It's like I got a Mac, I got a Windows machine, I got all these things. I got a Kindle Scribe that I really like to write on.
I feel like maybe an iPad mini would be a fun thing.
Yeah.
You don't have that form factor yet, other than the Kindle, I guess.
Right. And I have like now the Ioneo 2, which we talked about in the previous episode, which I really do like. So I don't know. I have only so much time in the world,
so much time.
Devendra.
It's sort of, especially with kids. So now like we have several iPads in our house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my daughter has one, which she just uses to watch shows and stuff and stream shows. And we hook it up to the car seat and she can use that. But I got this newer one, which can play better games and is faster for things like Minecraft. Mm-hmm. She's getting into that now. Mm-hmm. My wife has one, which she just keeps around her when she's watching stuff and dealing with the baby, too. So it is nice to like separate this computing and just have a slightly bigger screen available to you. So in that respect, it's nice. Anything else you want to mention?
So yeah, I mean, I'm also kind of looking at Matt's iOS 17 preview, which is on Engadget.com, by the way. And the one thing I forgot to mention is Standby, which is the lock screen interface that will show up and turn your iPhone into kind of a smart display when you are charging it and have it placed horizontal. So it technically is supposed to work. I think it took Matt till like very late in the game before it started showing up on his. So he seems to like it. And you can see, again, widgets that we were talking about. You can see
all
standby
widgets.
All widgets all day. So it's a lot of interesting use cases for some of this. And if you're really wanting an Apple-branded smart display, which is not existent in the moment, and that's like the goal, like one feature that you really need in your life right now, and you have a stand that, or a charging stand for
just
your
like
iPhone,
put your iPhone on the side, leaning up against a book,
right,
or something. Like,
right, you don't need a stand.
Yeah.
You could do that. Yeah. Then yeah, maybe that alone could be worth getting
something.
The beta for. Again, though,
get a wireless charging stand too, and just lay it horizontal and still charge and get that view. I've tried it, but I've noticed I don't see like a digital clock widget. The only widget I see is the analog clock. I'm like, I'm tired. My eyes are blurry. I'm not going to try to interpret clock hands right now. Just give me numbers, Apple. Make my life
easier.
What?
I love clock hands. What? Oh, we're going to throw down.
Clock hands are nice,
clock
but
hands.
If I'm blurry and just waking up, I'm looking at the clock like, should I be getting up now or should I go back to sleep? I want to look and see. I don't want to like figure out clock arms. So again, my little, I'm using one of those Echo Dots with the LED clock, and that is still, hey, glanceable information. No goddamn widgets. You know, it's a useful widget.
Yeah.
Just time with numbers. That's all I need.
I'm so upset. The Halo Rise is going to be completely useless in a couple of weeks, and I'm just so upset right now. I'm still really, I'm just mad at Amazon for canceling support for that. But okay,
anyway. That's it. They pulled a Google. That's what we'll call it every time they pull complete support for a product.
So annoyed.
I'll talk about macOS real quick because there's not much to say. I've been working on the preview this week, and it is really hard to write a lot about nothing. And that is kind of what it feels like.
That's our life.
It's real life because, listen, Apple cares about iOS. Apple cares about iPadOS and whatever the Vision Pro is, their whole spatial computing thing. I feel like the Mac is just like, well, it works. It's fine. We just gave you guys a whole new OS rebuilt for new chips a couple of years ago. What else do you want, right? I feel like they're deprioritizing Mac users, and you can really feel that. So it's fine. It's more macOS with a lot of these features we're talking about here. So widgets. Widgets are everywhere.
Widgets.
You can drag a widget over from the notification thing to your desktop. Hooray. Great. you get high resolution aerial screensavers. Great. Okay. Sure. Apple TV has had that aesthetic for almost a decade. Right. Like Apple TV 4K has been doing that forever. Not anything new. It just feels like the Mac is getting like the leftovers. Stage Manager last year was the same thing. They're getting the leftovers of all the innovation Apple's putting elsewhere. It's just funny to see. One thing I'll call out, I do think the wallpaper, the aerial screensavers are kind of cool because you can set one to also be your wallpaper. So like in your lock screen, you'll have a moving background. You could see like the beaches of Hawaii or something. And then when you log in, it slowly slows down and like settles into a static wallpaper. It's like, that's kind of a cool effect. I do wonder if somebody's going to hack the ability just to keep that video playing in the background. Like, give me a moving wallpaper I used to have in the Stardock days of Windows or something, you know?
I just think it's going to be such a battery drain, though, right?
Like, I don't know. Maybe only activates when you actually are looking at your desktop, too. It doesn't have to run when you're not looking at it.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
I'm just thinking, I'm sure somebody would want to hack that ability. And also, it is the year 2023. If you want me to get excited about screensavers, you know, make my wallpapers more futuristic or something. Just do something different here. WatchOS, anything else you want to mention, Sherlyn?
Yeah, I'm still in the zone of there's so much to check out. I think the big thing with WatchOS is how everything's been really redesigned to make better use of space on the screen. And I think I'm finding it nice to, I mean, who's spending that much time on their watch anyway, right? But when you are, like I am, sometimes I'm sitting there and like I don't want to be on my phone, but I do want to check out my fitness stats for the day. Things like the fitness app, the workout apps, they all just have better presentation of your data now. There's obviously a bit of redesign in the navigation. So pressing the action button on the right edge doesn't just bring up the dock anymore or your open apps anymore. It now actually brings up your settings. And then double clicking the crown is what brings up your open apps. Excuse me, which is what it will take a little bit of getting used to, but I think it makes more sense because now, though, the swiping up from the home screen gestures, that's my life, home screaming. Home screen, swiping up from your home screen now brings up the smart widget stack. I mean, that's what I'm saying, what I'm using for it. And the widgets here actually are just so much more helpful than any complication I've really used, unless I'm using the like modular pro screen, which lets you stick to sort of widget sized complications on the screen.
Are you still using now? You can Apple Watch Pro, by the way, the big boy or Ultra?
Ultra? No. Okay. No. I've been maining the Series 8. If only because the Ultra isn't really a good.
It's too big. Yeah.
No, it's more that I want to get a sense of like the most commonly used Apple Watch for my testing in future. I still have an Ultra just for like, you know.
You could just wear
testing
both.
Testing for the next time.
One on each
arm. I mean, if I really want to be dangerous and you know, be an offensive player. Whatever.
It's like modern Wonder Woman, just like an Apple Watch on each arm blocking.
Oh my God. Blocking people. That's what my Halloween costume is going to be this year. But I do like the way everything appears. Now you get much more information at a glance. And yeah, that's my main takeaway so far. I haven't really like formulated more of an idea. I did log my emotion one time during this process. It's really interesting to see where Apple's headed with the watch product and also in combination with iOS. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Did your Apple Watch just explode when you logged your emotion? What happened?
No, it was a good mood. It was like I am feeling pretty content right now. And then everything went to shit. So like, all right.
I almost wonder, because when you're doing that, if your Apple Watch, it has haptics, it has vibration. If it can sense you being a little down, can it give you a little wrist hug? That'd be a little
like when you can send a digital touch to your like friends, like little, that sort of thing.
Little wrist hug. Oh my God. Yeah,
maybe
it's totally. Actually, we have the tech to do that. All you need is like a little like add haptics to the actual armbands, which that's tougher. Those aren't powered, but the future does.
It's the future. We'll see.
I'm trying to tell you, my son Alexander, one of his favorite things is a squeeze hug, and now he has learned to do squeeze hugs. So when he wants to, he will just like squeeze me. Or my wife, so that's fun. Or his sister.
So sweet.
Now we need awesome. Our gadgets to do that. That's my takeaway from all this.
I don't want a robot hug, Dev. I don't know what you're talking about.
You like that weird headless plushy thing from CES, remember? The huggy doll, which also was like
the Yuffie? Yeah. I didn't like it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not the Yuffie, the full of flu, whatever it was. I don't want it.
Something I'm to give good, you a thanks. Hug and a thing. One quick thing I want to mention about macOS, by the way, there is a new presenter view that you can do in the video apps that are really cool. They showed this at the at the demo. So when you're sharing your screen, you could say, hey, put a little video of me in a circle, like yes. Brady Bunch mode at the bottom. Or you can make yourself big and at the front of it and your screen is behind you. So you can, yes. you can like talk about things. So that's cool. I'm pretty sure iPadOS does that too. But that's cool. I'm sure people will use that sometimes. It's sort of like if you're in a meeting and you have to share a spreadsheet and everyone's looking at the spreadsheet and it's just so boring and they can't really see what you're saying or like see you emoting. Like this is a way to kind of combine some of those things. So that's okay. Sure. That's a new thing in macOS. Any major takeaways from these betas, Sherlyn?
I am planning on breaking out a separate story, and that's part of why I've been so stressed this week because I have so many things to do. But the irony is that I'm planning on breaking out a separate story on what these new software updates, the sort of the mental health angle that Apple's taking with some of these, the journal app, the mental health, the logging your emotion. On Apple Health, I did the new anxiety risk and depression risk questionnaires. I have a friend who works in like clinical trials and stuff. So we were going over some of the questions and it's a pretty standard, like that's the industry standard questionnaire that they use too. So the fact that it's not just having them, but it's also kind of opening up awareness. It also allows for conversations around these sorts of topics and issues. I think it's worth looking at. So I'm still formulating a thought there, but I think there's something here. If you listening to this have, you know, experiences and real opinions on what Apple's doing here on the mental health space, you send us your thoughts, podcast@engadget.com.
That's super cool. I can almost imagine a fun crossover that will definitely never happen is sort of like working with the folks behind the bear. And just be like,
oh God, oh
every
God.
Time you're in the kitchen, everybody's screaming, Apple Watch is flashing red. Stop. Slow down.
It's like, I know it's like they should have like some sort of tie in with Netflix or the Apple Watch and Netflix. Oh, sorry, Hulu in this case. As you're watching the bear, if your heart rate rises while you're watching it, they'll like buzz to tell you like, hey, it's just a show. Calm down.
Oh, pause the show because you watch it to get your heart racing.
Yeah.
But yeah. I can imagine they do this the second season of The Bear, which I'm not sure if you'll ever watch, Sherlyn. But the second season is more about, I think it's more focused on like, okay, yeah, you are all super stressed and anxious. How do we like work with that? How do we move on? How do we, you know, help okay. our own, you know, help our own mental health basically. And they do this thing which is sort of the deaf community, the sign for saying I'm sorry is sort of like a heart, it's like rubbing putting a fist and rubbing your chest, and they just start doing that. Like, okay, they just blew up at each other. 30 seconds later, like, okay, I fucked up, you know, like that's on me. It is a really cool way of checking emotions, and I can almost imagine, again, like the Apple Watch hug, which will certainly happen someday. I can imagine Apple kind of being like, hey, kind of like alerting you out of something. So I don't know. I don't know what this could lead to. Let's talk about some other news. Some of the obvious stuff we have to hit. Over the weekend, we have been waiting for Meta's Threads to hit 100 million users because it's been growing so quickly. I think it did that Monday morning. I believe it was the day, July 11th.
Yeah, it was exactly. Yeah, Monday. That was Monday morning.
July 11th is a Tuesday, but I believe the story went up Monday morning from what I can see here. But anyway, it was less than a week. It was less than a week after this thing launched. I think the fastest growing app ever. Yep. Okay.
Am I surprised? No.
Are you surprised? I mean, how's your weekend been with Threads, Sherlyn? Because clearly it's got you.
So now that all that buzz and that constant buzzing of my phone has kind of died down and I've turned off kind of a lot of the notifications, I'm less like, you know, sucked back into it as I was at the start of it. It was really fun, right? Last week I was like really, wow, super into it. Now I think I treat Threads the kind of the way I've been treating Twitter lately, which is to have a lot of distance from it. I think I'm not as extroverted as I was before where like every little thought I had would go out there. But Threads is still on my homepage, my first screen on my homepage.
Oh, the coveted
space.
As
opposed to Twitter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I even took Twitter, I even took Instagram off of that. So like Threads has a better spot on my phone than Instagram does. I don't really know just yet. I think the engagements with people I have on there are still not where I want them to be. I think it's some of the shine from it all being new and fancy has worn off.
I mean, there's so many. I think the shine was all those notifications. Like once this thing launched, yeah. Like, hey, everyone's following you.
I will
they
say,
like me.
I will say,
yeah.
I will say, I hit my 1,000 followers. I think something like last night or this morning. Uh-huh. So yay, great.
It's great. I also want to point out, so, okay, 100 million users on Threads. We still don't know, like, what that will mean, ultimately. But clearly, it's big. And I do think, like, yeah, this, I didn't have much faith in it. But I think it will stick around to some degree.
Yeah.
To some degree. Yeah. Meanwhile, Elon Musk's response to all this is basically having a complete meltdown. So just, like...
I'm shaking my head.
Just shaking his head. So I'm going to say some things right here. And I don't know, hide your children's ears, I guess. I don't know.
Yes, cover your ears.
But he did tweet, Zuck is a cuck, which, again, the shitposting mind of a 10-year-old, that is what the head of Twitter has right now.
It gets worse, doesn't it?
It gets worse. And then he proposed a literal dick measuring contest. This is after, we didn't talk about this last week, but while I was on vacation, I also saw the news about, like, it seemed like that a potential cage match between Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg was close to happening. And then Elon Musk's mother said, like, don't do that. Like, don't hurt my boy. It was a whole thing. Almost clear, like, it's not actually happening, but it seemed like everybody was game to do it. And again, one of those things where, like, man, maybe our society should just crumble. Like, we are just at the precipice right now of civilization, apparently. But anyway... That is how Elon Musk is handling all this. Yeah.
Maybe his mom should talk to him and be like, calm down, child. Like, what?
I mean, she created this monster. So I don't think that's going to happen.
Who knows? Yeah, who knows? I know. I'm just like, all right.
That's the whole thing. In other news, Chinese hackers raided U.S. government email accounts by exploiting a Microsoft cloud bug. Microsoft confirmed this yesterday. The hacking group, I'm reading from TechCrunch here, the hacking group tracked as Storm 0558, compromised approximately 25 email accounts, including government agencies, as well as related consumer accounts linked to individuals associated with these organizations, according to Microsoft. So that's a pretty big deal. This is also, if you look at our history of stories around Microsoft and security and gadget, you'll see a lot of these hacks are very common. In this case, I believe the government agencies alerted Microsoft to this happening. So this is a particularly bad one because it happened over Microsoft 365 and they were just like caught completely flat-footed. Like they did not even know that this was happening. So bad news for Microsoft.
Not a good week for Microsoft.
Not a great week for Microsoft. Also not a great week for Microsoft because apparently Google's Bard AI chatbot has learned to talk, according to Andrew Tarantola. So it understands 40 languages. It can speak responses. You could also drop images in to give it information when you were talking to it. What do you think? Because that's one thing we can't do yet with Bing AI and ChatGPT, Sherlyn, is like actually talk to it. Would you use an AI more if you could?
I mean, that's kind of where it's been headed, right? With Google especially. Google's got this great speech recognition. It's experience. It's got assistant in all kinds of freestanding devices. It's got the not just speech recognition, but also like speech output, right? I mean, the fact that assistant was able to make its own phone calls to restaurants with duplex and talk to them and mimic pauses, mimic sounds of hesitation in those calls, that's what blew our minds, remember?
Have you actually used that feature, by the way, Sherlyn?
Duplex, yes, many times. I was working on a big story around it and then got scooped by The Verge, so thank you a lot, Verge, go away. No, I have used Duplex. Duplex is not actively, I think, being used by a lot of people, but Google uses it to update like restaurant information on maps to make sure that maps info about opening hours or like, I don't know what types of accessible entrances or types of credit cards accepted, whatever, right? It uses Duplex to get that information and update its software, update its knowledge graph.
Is it, are the restaurants just being called by Duplex? And then like people respond and it just, that's weird.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. I don't think but here's the thing. I don't think that they are either aware or they're always responding the right way. Yeah. Like, yeah, you know, So it's as once it works, and you will see, right? I'm sure you've seen this before, where if you like look at your maps thing and you see the opening hours of a restaurant, it goes last confirmed by phone call right. on, you know, last 9 weeks ago. Yep. That's what's happening. That's what's like, it's almost, it's, I don't know the actual mix of how much of it is automated and how much of it is what, but you know, I know Google is listening to this. We could do a story. Google's hey, hit me up. Let's talk about.
Yeah. Google's listening to everything. Have you ever actually used the reservation booking
Yes, I
thing?
Have. Yes, I have.
Did it work?
Yes. Yes, it did. You just have to be very explicit with it.
Uh-huh.
It does ask you a few questions, yeah, right? So basically yeah. you can go to Duplex and like, this is a fully like digital interface. You're not calling or talking to anyone, you're typing things. And it'll ask you for how many people, for what time, if this time's not available, what other times do you want? And then it'll do the calling for you and be like, okay, we'll have an answer for you in like an hour or so. And if it makes the reservation, if it's able to, and I was able to one time, I think this was for the Bao, by the way, yep. at St. Mark's Place.
Yep.
It made a reservation for something like 8 to 10 people. And that was great. Everything worked, right? Like it was like, okay, cool. And then it gives me a Google Calendar confirmation and all that stuff. Show up to the restaurant. It was like, they were like, oh, we don't have your reservation. So that was not great.
So it didn't work.
The sad thing is that, like, I think what happened was, like, uh-huh. the person who received the call and was like, yeah, okay. And then, like, says a confirm, right? Just was like, that sounded fake. And didn't do it. You know what I mean? Like,
This is what I'm saying. So this is a whole tangent on this stuff. But I'm like, I have been hesitant to use this feature because I feel bad for the restaurants. Nobody likes getting a robocall. If I hear a robocall, a marketer calling me at home, instant hang up. It seems like a weird thing to push on everybody. But anyway, this is all Google has been doing good stuff around this. I just feel weird because just make a phone call. I know millennials. I know it's hard, but you know,
we get to talk
to humans.
I think
that's all we are all we have. These Google bards will not save us. You know, can't even make a reservation.
So what I think is that that's why Duplex has been repurposed kind of to do this other thing that is doing in the background, which is to update all the information. Because I think the restaurant reservation thing just didn't really take off. I think A, people didn't really know or trust that it would work, and rightly so. And then B, like, yeah, restaurants maybe didn't, you know, get on board.
I am totally sympathetic to the restaurants being like, oh, are you a human or are you a freaking Google robot trying to, you know, deal with me right now and just hang up.
I'm trying to find like other reservations I made. Yeah. So, okay. So this thing says your Google Assistant restaurant reservation at. Okay. So let me see. So this is the interface I have. April 17, 2019, I made a reservation through Google Assistant at the Bao for 8 people, 8:30 p.m. It says, hi, Sherlyn. I'll try calling the business now to request your reservation and we'll update you in the next 15 minutes. And this is all in my inbox. It goes, confirmed. Your reservation is confirmed for blah, blah, blah. Reservation's under my name and my phone number. Uh-huh. And then, yeah, I remember showing up and just not.
I'm glad I asked about this, about Google's voice expertise, because just having the technology isn't enough. But okay, anything else you want to mention about Google Bard learning how to talk, Sherlyn?
Not much. Okay. We'll see. Oh, I'm looking at my inbox to see what else I tried. April 2nd, I tried reserve with Google for a place called Tipsy Shanghai, and the reservation was never made. Apparently. Yeah, I never got a confirmation that the reservation ever got successfully confirmed. I just got, the assistant is, you know, working on your request for Tipsy Shanghai. Great.
Uh-huh. 30-second call would have probably worked for you too. So it's the whole thing.
Yeah, plus I speak Chinese. Yeah. So it's really easier for me when I call a Chinese restaurant.
It'll be easier for you. Listen, bring back phone calls. I know it's cringe, millennials, but make it happen. Just make it talk to people. We have a couple fun stories. We reported on this thing. Chipotle is testing a guacamole robot called the Autocado. It is you dump the avocados at the top, and it does all the peeling and the coring. It splits it, and I don't know how much of the work it's actually doing to make guacamole, but it seems like a bunch of it.
Yeah, I think it's just coring and peeling.
Like, it doesn't
mashing
do
and smashing.
But that's,
yeah,
honestly, that is the part that takes forever because it's not that
yes,
hard to smash.
Yes, exactly. The rest of the part's fun, actually. Yeah.
So a typical batch of guacamole at Chipotle takes 50 minutes to make. This should significantly make that smaller. They're testing this in California. I just think our title kind of perfectly encapsulated it. Chipotle's Guacamole Robot's Cursed Appeal and Core Avocados for Eternity. That is the Rick and Morty joke about, you know, so what good, is my so purpose? To, you just slice the butter, man. That's it. That's yes. why you exist. That's cool. I love avocados. I hate peeling and getting them out because I have to do that often for the kids. Give me an avocado.
Well, give me also an auto mango, please, because I found some really delicious mangoes near me and in a store near me. And having to peel, cut, whatever the fuck. I'm sorry. Yeah. having to cut them up and see, remove the pit.
I mean, geez,
it's just so annoying.
Sherlyn, you're talking to me like a civilized person. The only way to eat a mango properly is to grab a mango, go to the sink, and eat it like a goddamn animal. Just like tear Savage. It open with your feet, with your teeth, and just like, nom, 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 nom.
Oh my God.
Go straight to the seed. Yeah. All yeah. No, you peel the, you bite the skin off.
Yeah. You peel it.
You peel okay, it. Yeah. You peel it. But you just go straight. You don't need to cut it. Who are you trying to impress with your mango slices?
I cube it. That's the impressing? Way my mom did it for me.
Yeah.
Me. Okay.
I love getting a batch of mangoes and just like going ham at the sink. That's the only way to go because I'm spending my life cutting things for the kids. I'm done. I'm tired. Also, fun news, researchers find evidence of organic matter on Mars. This was a story, basically the organic molecules they discovered in one region, which is cool. I still feel like we're waiting for that micro, you know, early life. What's up?
No, and it's also unclear yet, like the origin of that organic matter, right? Like whether it was like from Mars or whether it was like brought there from other things.
I mean,
things
not brought there. It just ends there. Like space stuff moves. Like,
or, yeah.
It gets a meteorite or asteroid hits and stuff gets moved around. Right. This is cool news. I think the cooler space news. Did you see the thing about basically the planet that is really close to its sun that is basically a giant mirror because it has clouds made of metal?
Oh wow!
Just like
no, I didn't
wild.
Know that.
It, like,
but that's the only way to survive being close to your sun, right?
It's like, also it was like a hot Jupiter, like a big gas so giant, cool. but also really close to the sun. It's just imagine seeing that. That is a cool yeah. like thing. I used to enjoy just watching, reading astronomy books and imagining what future, you know, what things look like far off. But anyway, organic mm-hmm. matter on Mars. Maybe we will learn more. I'm hoping we do. Let's talk about some things around Engadget. Sam Rutherford reviewed the Asus ROG Ally, the thing we have all been waiting for. It's Asus's more powerful Steam Deck competitor.
Yeah.
Gave it a score of 82. He really likes it with a couple trade-offs.
For what it's worth, that's 1 point higher than the Steam Deck when Jess reviewed it. So okay. So I edited this piece. Sam's main thing is that like, yeah, I mean, sometimes the so the performance Asus obviously boasted double the performance of the Steam
it's
Deck,
fast,
and
yeah.
you know it doesn't quite meet that, but it is significantly faster because of the AMD Z1 Extreme chip that's in there. The ROG Ally also has a better screen. It's got like good sound, but more importantly, it doesn't constantly whine. The fans are not just constantly blaring in the background, which is nice.
Oh, I had. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been talking with Sam about this because I've been reading coverage elsewhere and listening to people talk about this. From what I hear, it should be blowing those fans more often because it gets so hot. It is hot. Yeah. It is hard to touch the back of this thing for some people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently,
no, I'm not surprised.
The build quality is all over the place. Sam did not see this issue, but I believe Jeff Gerstmann over at his podcast mentioned when it overheats, the SD card just pops out. It's like
oof.
It's like poops out because it's
is it so, using the slot as a vent?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, the heat needs to escape somehow, but you know the metal is like, you know, expanding. Yeah. Like and if your game is running off that SD card, like you're just screwed. Like and you didn't
yeah,
save, you're
terrible.
Just hosed. It sounds like I think a lot of people are suggesting you wait for a second gen for Asus to iron
yep.
some of this stuff out. Yeah.
It's also worth noting the ROG Ally, just the battery life is definitely not as long as the Steam Deck. I mean, given the sort of heat mm-hmm. issues and the mm-hmm. fact that the performance is so much higher, that kind of makes sense. So I would say the two are almost neck and neck in terms of performance. The ROG Ally also costs a shit ton more money. It's like, what, $700? With the highest spec Steam Deck only $650.
And also the Steam Deck is going on sale more often. It was 20% mm-hmm. off recently, so you could get that high-end version for under $500. I still love my Steam Deck. I still tell people, like, if you are into these things and you don't want to wait for this whole field to settle down, the Steam Deck is still a good deal. And don't forget, folks, the ROG Ally also runs Windows. And when we say it runs Windows,
yes.
It runs Windows.
It sucks.
It runs full it sucks. Windows. You are bouncing around Windows 11 with a joystick and gamepads and stuff. You can do what I showed Trillin and turn on Steam at big picture mode. But again, you have to launch Steam. You have to do a lot of Windows stuff until you get there.
And even then, it's not a perfect solution. I think so. The Steam Deck uses Valve's Steam OS, which is better built for machines like this. And Windows just is not great. And also, I mean, somewhat related is that the ROG Ally doesn't have the touchpad that the Steam OS Steam Deck does.
Which is good for RTS
games. So for keyboard and mouse games.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So like that excludes those games from being played, and also like it does just make supposedly makes Windows 11 a little bit easier to navigate, but you don't have that on the ROG.
You can
Ally,
use them as mouse trackpads, yeah.
Exactly, but then you don't have that on the ROG Ally. So like, all right, screw you.
One thing I would recommend if you guys want to check this out, apparently Best Buy is selling these things, and I will give you all my greatest pro tip for Best Buy. It's no questions asked returns, folks. So if you just want to take a look at the hardware and put it through its paces, and like I think you have 2 weeks typically, but I think for the during the pandemic they even extended that. But yeah, just try it for a week, and if it does not work for you or if you notice these issues, return it. It doesn't hurt anybody. It's totally fine. Also, want to shout out the piece by Katie. Katie Malone,
our new security reporter.
Yeah, what the hell are passkeys and why are they suddenly everywhere? This is a very good question. I'm glad she asked it and answered it in this piece. So go check that out. Let's move on to what we're working on. I'll talk about this soon, but I just saw Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. I'm working on a piece around that, and I'm juggling a bunch of
I skipped the
reviews.
Screening for that, by the way. I was like, I had an invite to go watch that, and I was like, oh, I have so much work this week. So this is supposed to be earlier this week.
But
okay. You did, but this is right when Apple was like, yeah.
Yeah, you got to work on all your previews now. Thank you, Apple. Do you have anything else you're working on you want to bring up, Trillin?
Oh, the WatchOS piece, editing the ROG Ally. We had back to school stuff to still work on. I have Samsung coming up. And this week, I took a secret meeting that I am not allowed to tell anybody about, me and Sam.
Okay.
But it is about a very anticipated product that will be coming out at some point this year. And just a guess. That's all I guess. A guess who I saw. Anyway, it was important enough that I took time out of this week to go and talk to these people about it. So stuff is happening. And I will just say that whatever you expect might be true is true.
Okay. I have absolutely no idea what you're even talking about at this point. It's
good.
It's gotten so convoluted.
I need to cover my butt.
Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Anything you want to shout out? Or have you just been so busy?
I'm like, what am I do? I recommend a massage, all right? Like that's that sounds good. You know, I want a massage.
I would love a massage.
I was gonna say.
Don't book it via Google Reserve, apparently. Google reservation. Because it seems like that would go badly. I saw Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. I loved it. I love the series. I already wrote about the 4K Blu-rays when those came out. But this one, not to spoil too much, this one is about AI. And actually, it's kind of funny.
I wish I had seen it now.
Basically, the plot of Mrs. Davis is this Mission Impossible. I did not expect to see that, but I love the series so much. Say what you will about Tom Cruise, but he is somebody who's at least very committed to making good movies and, you know, doing as much as he can himself. And these movies, especially the Christopher McQuarrie Mission Impossibles, are just so well made. Like, the action is so good. Like, the chases are so good. And it's Tom Cruise himself doing most of this stuff. And the set pieces are so smart and they're so intricate, and I love the characters. So I love this series of films, but in particular McQuarrie's version. So if you have not seen Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, Trillin, I would maybe start there. Also, Ghost Protocol is a fun one because that has the Dubai sequence. It's a great series. It is, I think, especially after rewatching a bunch of them, I think it's the best action franchise we have right now. And I'm saying even better than John Wick. And I love John Wick. So,
I mean, yeah,
this is the thing everybody should be watching and praising, because I think the MCU movies have just like broken our brains a little bit. You know, I like those movies just fine. But the artifice of them and the sort of like cookie cutter nature
over CGI,
right. The cookie cutter nature of so many of them, the fact that they all have to lead into each other. It just kind of tell me a good story. Show me like cool people doing, you know, impossible things. And this series certainly does that. see Mission Impossible on the biggest screen you can, and I'll be working on something hopefully to go up this week or early next week. And I don't know, games. I forget if I mentioned this last week, but Dave the Diver. I'm spending a lot of time on that on my Steam Deck. It is a great chill game where you go fishing and do deep sea fishing, run a sushi restaurant at night, and it also escalates over time where...
Oh my God, that's awesome!
It's a lot of things you like, Shalene, but it also escalates to a point where you find an underwater civilization and you have to fight pirates, and like it escalates like what the systems of the game are to the point
Dave
where...
Dave the Diver?
Dave the Diver. At one point, you fight a giant squid. You know, like it's just... It is so fun and so cool and chill.
Is it on Steam?
It's on Steam. It's not very expensive. It is very...
Can you hear the fans of this dumbass INAO2 coming on?
I cannot hear the fans, but fans are good. Okay. Fans means less heat.
I know.
So I never complain about fans.
But it's so loud.
It's very loud. Okay. You know what's great? It are headphones. Just plug those in, play your games. It's great.
Yeah, but it's still loud.
It's still loud. Anyway. Dave the Diver, I'm just, it is nice to have a game, a break from like Zelda, where I feel like I love Zelda, but every time I'm there, I'm like, okay, I gotta do stuff. I'm accomplishing things. I gotta go find a new shrine. I'm dealing with the story.
Ooh,
it's on sale.
It's on the front page
I think it just,
and it's on sale for 10% off.
Buy it right now. I think it just hit a sales milestone. I think it's from a Korean or Japanese developer. But the art is so good. The music is so good. It's really fun and quirky. And it is a great break if you just want to like chill. If you want to chill, do some fishing, run a little restaurant at night, hire employees. I like all these things.
Eccentric characters with a lighthearted narrative. This animation is funny.
It's really cute. And it has great pixel art. And all you need to sell me is great pixel art. So anyway, Dave the Diver, check it out, folks. Definitely worth it, especially if you have a Steam Deck. I'm sure this is a perfect Switch game, so maybe eventually it'll head over there. I haven't heard about that release.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra at mastodon.social. I'm also at Devendra on Blue Sky. I am on Threads, but I am not checking Threads, so I'm sorry. That's the one I just will not live with. Find me on Mastodon. I'm trying to like get my thoughts out there. Yeah.
Send me your best and favorite, I guess, handheld PC game ideas. I am at Sherlyn Lowe still on Twitter. I occasionally check that, I guess. I am at Sherlyn Instagram on Threads and Instagram. Email us your thoughts and, you know, whether you want the live streams back, send them to podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. The swiping up from the home screen gestures, home screen. This is my life home screaming.